You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to this week's episode of Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week we have Colby West on the show. And Colby's story of becoming a professional skier is a rags-to-riches story. We'll talk about how he dropped out of college, left everything on the East Coast, moved out west, and chased the dream of becoming a professional skier. Colby will tell us all about living in a car that first year and then finding themselves on X Games podiums in the years to follow and the sponsorships that came along with those medals. And we'll find out about Colby's real talents, his ability to perform and entertain, and how he's going to use those skills as he enters the next chapter in his life now that his professional ski career is over. So sit back and enjoy an amazing talk with Colby West.
All right, I'm just taking a dump. Let me call you back.
I have no problems with that whatsoever.
Well, I'm still in push mode, so you might get some pushes in there.
Yeah, if there's any noise, maybe we'll edit it out.
All right, sweet.
Cool. Well, I thank you for coming on, and I haven't talked to you in quite a while. But we do have some history together, and I want to just talk about your history in the ski industry. I know you as a skier, you have an interesting story. I know you started skiing around 13, and you're from the East Coast. And where are you from exactly?
I'm from New Hampshire. I'm from Canterbury, New Hampshire, which is like tiny little town just north of Concord. Yeah, I grew up there though.
You started skiing around 13, and I read that you were the only skier really in your family. I'm going to say that you skied every day and you probably got really badass in the park because that's how most people come up. But how did you get connected with your first brand?
Yeah, well, when I first started skiing, it was with a school program. I went to a public school in Belmont, and we skied once a week, and I took lessons when I was 13, I think. I was snowboarding and skiing, but my knees weren't good enough to snowboard. It's like getting on the lift, you had to like twist them around and shit, and it hurt a bunch. So yeah. I started skiing more often, and then I went back to snowboarding actually, like about when I was like 15 or 16, snowboarding and skiing. But like the snowboarding scene was so like I couldn't even go in the park with my skis on, but I could with my snowboard on. I didn't really understand that. I thought it was kind of stupid. I was like, I'm the same fucking person. What the fuck is the difference?
Right.
So I stuck with skiing because it's kind of like the more badass outcasty type thing to do. And I never did moguls or anything. I just really liked skiing in the park. And then when I was in college, I went to college for a year at Plymouth State, right near Waterville and Loon.
Okay.
I didn't have a car or anything, so I would like hitchhike or get a ride from other ski friends up to the mountain. And I didn't have a normal college experience, that's for sure. I had a dorm room to myself by chance.
Nice.
And I just would wake up every day at 7:30, go to class from 8 until 10, and then I would hitchhike or go to the mountain with friends. It was like rain or shine. I skied like 45 days in a row or something. I remember at one point I was the only person on the mountain. I came down on the lift operator. It's pouring rain. And he's like, what the fuck are you still doing? Like, what are you doing? You're the only one I've seen in the last like 45 minutes. And I'm like, well, I just want to go skiing. I ended up getting bored, just jumping around the park and stuff. And not bored, but I was just by myself. And I can actually brag that I've skied every single run at Waterville Valley backwards, including the mogul runs and the tree runs. I wanted to see if I could do them all.
That's amazing. You always skied the trees backwards?
Yeah, I skied the trees. It's slow going, but that I think that definitely helped. It was just doing it over and over and skiing everywhere I possibly could and just doing tricks all the time. But getting to the sponsorship part, when I was 15, my friend went to summer camp in Whistler up at High North Ski Camp.
Nice.
Which was Shane Zox's ski camp. And he went there and came back and he was like, holy shit, dude. Like, fucking everybody's there. Like, Shane Zox and Mike Atkinson and like, Pep Fuhas was there. And just anybody that was anybody at the time, JF Cousin, I think, was there as well. And JP and Anthony Baranowski. And so he was like, you gotta go. And I was like, well, shit, yeah. Like, sorry, am I swearing too much? Can I swear?
No, you can swear as much as you want.
Okay, hold on. I'm just finishing up my dump here.
Okay.
I had Chipotle last night.
Nice. And how did it look today?
Pretty good. It was definitely corn in my burrito, so.
Yeah, that always looks the same afterwards.
Hold on, I gotta wash my hands. Always wash your hands. Come with me, pal. We're going to my room.
All right. I can't wait to go to your room, Colby.
Okay. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah. So High North. I saved up my money. I worked at an apple orchard in the summertime, and then I saved enough and flew out to Whistler. It was the first time I'd ever left New England, actually.
Whoa.
And yeah, and I got to Vancouver, and we're driving up. It was super late. It was like maybe like 1 o'clock in the morning. I had transferred in Montreal, so I forgot, or I didn't know. I can't even say I forgot. I didn't know that you had to transfer your bags when you went international.
Okay.
My bags stayed in Montreal. When I got to Vancouver, I didn't have a ski bag. I didn't have any bags at all. And they picked me up and we started driving. It was when they were doing the construction. So I'm super jet lagged because I'd never traveled, and it's 3 hour difference. And we had to stop because they were doing the construction. They were doing blasting. So we got stuck in Squamish at a gas station until 4 o'clock in the morning.
Jesus.
Finally got up there, and I still hadn't even seen the mountains yet. Because the mountains there are ridiculous, and especially compared to the East Coast. And
Right.
so I woke up in the morning and it was like dizzying. I looked at the mountain. I was like, this is a fucking scheme. Like, how does this exist? Like, what is this? It's just so massive and crazy. And so, Shane Zox, who's, I probably have like two or three people that I look to as I wouldn't have a career in skiing. And he was sort of like my, mentor, and he was like the godfather at
Yeah, he
the
was.
time. And so, he was like, okay, we can get you some stuff. I think I wore Mike Atkinson's clothes. So I had these super big baggy clothes 'cause he's tall. And he let me have some of the demo K2s that they had. And then he gave me some boots that were some Japanese boots. Oh, geez, I can't remember the name of it. It started with a G. Anyway, but those were my first days, my first 2 days at camp. I was on everybody else's shit. And just being around all the pros, and it was super inspiring. I think I learned like six new tricks. I learned how to do like cork nines and a whole bunch of stuff. And so it was amazing. And I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to be a pro skier. And I could see that it was, that it was, I don't know, I had to do it. So
Attainable.
yeah, it seemed attainable for sure. And I realized that, learning the tricks was, yeah, I just kept pushing at it. So then, let's see what happened after that. Then that the I went back east, and I did a some competitions. It was like the Kahlua Half Pipe Jam,
Yeah, I
and
remember that. Sacred Hunger Tour.
yeah, and so I had some line skis, I think. No, I had Salomon Exendos, which,
I remember those carving skis.
yeah, they were carving skis. They were like slightly turned up at in the back enough that I could do 540s and stuff.
Okay.
And I did a Switch Misty 7 because I was like trying to figure out how I could do like what I could do to win, and I couldn't hit the jump switch because I always caught my tips. And so I just did what I felt like, and I just hucked a Switch Misty 7, which kind of became my trick for the next couple of years.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because I was trying to be innovative. It was more like a desperation in that first competition. And I ended up winning it. And Mike, I ended up winning it, and they gave me a free pair of skis of K2 Public Enemies.
Yep.
And so I remember Mike Atkinson was the host there, and I had seen him at camp. He didn't know who I was or anything, but he was on the microphone and he was super funny, and he was just ripping through the half pipe. And he was really the first pro I think that I looked at, and I was like, yeah, that's the kind of pro skier I want to be. Like, he wasn't just a real badass skier. He had the ability to talk in the mic and entertain. I saw him as an entertainer, not just as a skier.
Yeah.
I actually told him that later on, and I think that he took that as I thought he wasn't. That I was knocking his skiing, which of course, he was a fucking amazing skier. Yeah, he was my hero for sure. And so then the next year, sorry, it's taking a while. I
Oh, it's
don't
all good, man. It's all good. I don't even have to
know.
ask questions. You're just giving me the story.
Yeah. So the next year, I was trying to save up, and I didn't have enough money to go back to camp. And so I emailed with Shane, and I got on a phone call, I think, with him. And I was like, I don't think I can make it to camp. And he was like, well, just get the flight and figure something out when you get here. And I was like, all right, well, for sure. So I got on the plane and went out there and did a session of camp. At the end of the session, he was like, do you want to stay on as a digger? And of course, I was like, yeah, of course I want to stay on it. So then, yeah, he like, I think who Mike Goot was there, who was the K2 team manager that week. And so Shane was like, this is Mike Goot, you should chat with him. And he told Mike that he should sponsor me. And Mike was like, let's ski around together. And I was like, all right, sweet. So we go up to the top and he was like, all right, can you do a switch five? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I did a switch five. And then he was like, can you do this trick? And I was like, yeah, I can do that. And so I just did it. I'd never done it before. And he's just telling me to do all these tricks. And he was like, all right, sweet. I'll give you some skis. that was my first sponsorship.
I talked to him the other day and I was like, so how did that go down with Colby? And he's like, you know what? We were skiing laps and I just made him do tricks. I was like, hey, do this, do this, do this, do this. And he's like, if he was going to miss one of those tricks, I wasn't going to give him skis. He's like, but he stuck everything first try. And it was like, all right, man, you're on the program.
Yeah. And at that time it was like 720s and 540s and like a 900 and shit like that. yeah, it was interesting. I remember, what was his name there? Who else was there? One of the other coaches skied up and was like trying to be like, do this one, you pussy. And I was like, okay, I'll do that one. Yeah. It was such a crazy environment because all the skiers, I remember one time I was like at the top of one of the rails. It was like this rail that had stairs next to it. It was just a down rail.
Okay.
And the diggers are all there. And like Ryan Schmies, I remember, was digging and he was kind of like making fun of me. I'm just like this 17-year-old kid. This is before I was on the dig team.
Okay.
And he was like, just hit the rail. And then Pep skis up. And I kind of felt like the diggers were hardcore, man. Like they were like there's like the rock stars up there that just fucking waking up hungover and going up there and fucking digging and then just riding all day. And so I was super intimidated and Pep skis up and I felt a little bit better. But then Pep goes, he was like, do a firecracker, like just ski down the stairs. And I was kind of like, okay, like, I'm not really going to do that. Like I only have one pair of skis. And Pep says, see that string between your legs? And I was like, what? He's like, see that string? Just pull that out and fucking do it, pussy. And I was like, oh. And then he just skis down the stairs. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'll go home now.
Right. So at High North, you kind of get your start with K2. And I know, you know, our history goes back as there was a point where you dropped out of college. You got, I think you had like a 1990 Saab at that point and drove cross country and kind of left life behind and followed the dream of becoming a pro skier. I know your parents couldn't have been too happy with that. And what was that whole experience like in your life? What was going on there?
Well, I kind of got lucky with my parents. My parents got divorced when I was really young. So I was
super lucky.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound so lucky, but I got lucky with my parents' mentality. So I was raised by my mother, essentially. I see my father on the weekends, and she had like three jobs, and it was pretty rough. And when I got to college and I was skiing every day and I was, you know, doing really well with that, I got another sponsor. I had Smith, who gave me goggles. And so after the first year, I got some college debt and I was like, I don't get this. You know, I was taking writing and English classes and it was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And I talked to my mom and I was like, I think I could be a pro skier. I really want to try it. And she was like, well, I'm still in college debt. So if you don't want to do it right now, you don't have to. And you can do whatever you want. If you think you can do it, then go ahead. And so I bought a car, $500 for a 1989 Saab, that I could fit in the back. I'm not a very tall person, so I got pretty lucky.
Yeah.
And I quit and I drove out and went out to the US Open. Got in the US Open, it didn't do super well, but I slept on the couch at the K2 house. That's where I met Boothie and Pettit as well. And who else was there? Biolo, I think.
Yeah.
but I just slept on the couch and then I went to other events and tried to get her going. I had like $500 and nothing really happened that first. I mean, I got into some photo shoots, to just shoot with Nate Abbott where I hit like an urban rail in Aspen or something. I slept on the couch at the X Games and oh my God, Rory Silva was there. He is such a crazy dude.
Was that the X Games where he cut the cyst out of his neck with a dirty steak knife?
Wearing a scarf the whole time, and Schmies was like, what are you wearing a scarf? And I remember just looking, I was so shocked by this human, man. He's such a crazy dude. I remember he had his room and it was like just pile of clothes and shit. Like he just destroyed his little condo room and it was like made his own nest in there, and he's just like, yeah, I can do that. Yes, he did. And he had a scarf on the whole time. And he's like, well, I got this thing on my neck, and like pulls down the scarf and it's this huge fucking cyst. It was like a boil on his neck.
Oh.
And it's
pussing and bleeding. And he's like, yeah, I tried to like cut it out. And he had like tried to cut it out of his neck with a fucking steak knife or something like that. And Smeed was like, dude, you got to fucking go to the hospital, man. And that was fucking, he's a crazy dude. I saw him like maybe 2 years ago again. I was like, hey, what's up? And just no recognition in his eyes. He's just like in his own planet.
Yeah, he came up the other day on the Sean Pettit show. I was asking Sean who the best skier that never was. And that was Rory right away in Sean's mind.
Yeah, he had this ridiculous style. I guess you could call it style. It's just wacky, but like he had like a get the job done in the air type of skiing. I think it was that he just do it, and however it came out, you could just watch and you knew it was him immediately skiing down. But he was pretty nasty though.
So I'm gonna fast forward a little bit because your career kind of ramped up, and I want to cover a whole lot in the interview. So you're on K2 at some point. K2 doesn't have the money to really make it worth your time. So you go over, I believe, to Vocal next. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. After that second year where I wrote out this massive plan or like a thing. I even wrote out all my expenses, everything, and I showed how much I was spending, where I was able to get to, the shoots I was doing, like where I was going, like thinking it's this super professional way of presenting, like, you know, I just need enough budget that I can continue. Like, I think this is going to work. And Goot wasn't, I mean, I guess he didn't have the budget. I was asking for like $500. He was like, I don't think we can do that. And then Shane called him, I think. Shane Zox, again, called him and was like, hey, man, like, can you do anything? And so he's like, all right, we can do that. And then Vocal came in and they were like, we'll give you $5,000. And I was like, oh fuck, like I could actually like make a career out of that. That was like big fucking money. And I was like, dude, what the fuck do I do? And I had this huge moral I had to like break it down for like what I thought would be the best thing to do. And it was heartbreaking because it was like I felt like K2 didn't care, but at the same time I sort of understood that I wasn't established. And then like that was like my first experience with like I got my emotions involved in it, which I, you know, obviously you can't really do that when you're dealing with money and sponsors and shit.
Yeah.
And so I was sad that I wasn't going to be on K2. I mean, I loved the skis and they were about to come out with that, the silencer ski.
Yeah.
I only wore all black. I listened to like death metal and like, I was just so pumped on that type of branding, but I just couldn't do it. I just didn't have any other means of income. So I went with Vocal, and it turned out to be fantastic over there. And I mean, I still have a good relationship with the K2 side of things. I mean, we're chatting right now.
Yeah.
Then when I went to Vocal, they had this sick ski. It was like the first fully symmetrical ski. And it's kind of funny. Since then, I've only skied a symmetrical ski.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they supported me in that next year. And that next year I emailed and begged to get on the, get into the X Games. And, finally they let me in as a third alternate, and so you get to practice with everybody, but I had to wait till, you know, three people dropped out, and Jakob, actually two people got hurt, I think. I don't remember who they were, but that was the year Pep and Andy were in the X Games as well. I don't think they invited them back because they did like zero spins and stuff, and
they were on Hellbents too.
Yeah, they were on like these ridiculous skis. Like I don't know what their plan was, but they were definitely there to enjoy it.
Yeah, it sounded like they had a good time, and they were on the 120 underfoot skis, which is really not what you need at the X Games.
No, not really, but it was cool to watch. So Jakob Wester actually was chatting, and he was like, this course sucks, man. I can't get any speed. It's dumb. And I was like, well, you don't necessarily have, I mean, you don't have to do it if you don't want to, if you think it's stupid. If you don't do it, then I get to do it. And he was like, yeah, fuck it. Like, you do it. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, fuck, I don't care. I just want to go ski in the backcountry and shit. And I was like, all right. And so I snaked in there and I got third place behind Sammy Carlson and Candide Tovex.
That's amazing. And that's a hell of a podium to be on.
Yeah. And they gave me fucking $10,000. Sick. And so after that, I was like, wow, this is all right. And I changed the exhaust on my car and like fixed it up because I had a hole in it and ate some real food instead of ramen.
Was that when you felt like you made it? I know you told me a story once where your dad kind of saw your name up on the X Games scoreboard and was like, you made a good decision.
Yeah, he came to that X Games, that very first one, and that's when he was like, all right. And he saw the crowds, he saw everybody there, and then I was one of the, I guess you could say, elite now. You know, I made it as a you know, at least competing. I mean, I didn't feel like I wouldn't consider myself like a pro skier at that time, but definitely that led into, it was just like a, you know, when, I mean, you could say when it rains, it pours, but that sounds negative, but you know, it was like, it was just kind of like a crescendo after that. And then I got third the next year in half pipe and fourth in slope. And then I got, and I won the US Open big air. And then I got third again the next year. So it was just kind of like a wave.
So you're riding that wave and you're the only dude doing everything. You're doing pipe, slope, big air, and that's unique.
Yeah, there was a couple that were doing everything, but people would focus on like one or the other. Jossi was actually my first X Games. I was 21 and Jossi was 16 and he broke his collarbone. I got third, but we've technically had the same amount of time. It's just really funny because he's so much younger than his career. And also he's so much better than I am. He's got this mentality is so much better. I was always not fine with third place, but I definitely was not complaining. I wasn't the type of person to be like third, fuck, like I got to win. Like I remember 2 years, like my third medal, Sammy was on the podium in second. I think he was like disappointed. And I was like, what the fuck?
You're celebrating. You're like, woo, I got third.
Yeah, fuck yeah. I get to sit next to these motherfuckers. This is great. But I never had that ridiculous drive to be number one. I guess once I got that medal, the first one, I would say like within that next year, I did feel like I had made it. And so that actually helped me do better again and get another medal and another medal. And my strategy going into events was always like, do what I know how to do. I didn't have that like TJ Schiller where he's like, well, fuck, I got to do a fucking 1820 or like a 1440 now to fucking beat this motherfucker. And like, oh, that's, well, he wasn't that negative, but he's like, you know, he always steps it up. It's the same with a lot of the boys. Then I didn't really have that.
But you'd go with not a safe run, but a run you knew you could land so you'd get a good score and hopefully be on the podium.
Well, I would do, my game was more like consistency. So I would come up with the tricks that I wanted to learn, or, you know, we're all watching each other. We all ski with each other and we're friends, so we can see what's going on. And we knew what the X Games course was going to be like, or other courses, or, you know, this is just a big air jump. And so I would plan out my run way beforehand, which I'm sure a lot of people do, but then when I got there, I would stick to that run. So I qualified that next year. I qualified first, which means I dropped last, but inevitably everybody steps it up for their finals run. So I was in fifth from my final run. And, I went down to the bottom. I was going to try a double 12 or something. I hadn't done it. And I went down to the bottom and talked with my monster team manager. And I was like, I could go up there. If I do my run, I'll get third. If I do the double 12, I'll win. And he was like, well, what are you going to do? And I was like, I'm going to do my run and get third. And so I went up and I did it and I got third again.
Yeah, I mean, that's a smart thing. I mean, if you blow up on the double, then you get nothing. And you need to get money to pay to live your life.
Yeah, I guess you could say no guts, no glory, but I didn't really have, I mean, my glory was third place, so.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were doing everything you could to become a professional skier. And then when you got to be a professional skier, you realized you weren't going to win every week, but you knew you could get on the podium if you did what you knew you could do, and doing that smart.
And it worked out in a lot of other competitions as well. I mean, like I'm pretty short, but I'm also pretty heavy. I guess I could use the word dense. So I usually have speed if other people didn't have speed. And so that kind of brought me through. So if it was snowing or something, it was my day, because I could just be consistent no matter what the weather or the conditions were.
Understood. You're at the peak of your career. I feel like you're on podiums and, yeah, you know, you've got a great sponsor in Vocal, but then you switch over to Corrupt. And how did that come about? And was it purely a money play?
Corrupt was, it was interesting because it was this company that came out of nowhere. They had this, the name Corrupt. We were kind of like, what is this?
Yeah.
But the thing that I really liked about Corrupt was, yeah, they offered more money because, you know, I was still peaking at that time. That was just the way all the sponsors were going. But they offered me a pro model. And I was like, the chance to design my own ski. I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, give me that. And that was a big factor for me, as well as, you know, TJ was going to be on the team, Dory and Gus Kenworthy, and like I am Richie Perman, who is a good friend of mine. So it's like, it was sort of like we were creating our own little family there.
Yeah, it seemed like they were coming in, they were going to create the super team right away.
Yeah, and it was awesome. We had such a good time. They did things that other companies hadn't done for me, or for us as a team, it was like we had team building. So we went over there in November or no, October. And yeah, we went over to France, like in the south of France, and he gave us all like a 1 year lease on Mini Coopers, and it was really crazy. It really felt like we were something special, which I think, you know, as a sponsor, that definitely helped us get really excited about the brand and the fact that we could design our own skis. Like, what else could you ask for? And so we went over there, we went go-kart driving and went, you know, spelunking and did all these crazy things. And actually at one point we went in November, and I brought my friend Mike Stack with me, who was essentially my manager. He was just my best friend that would travel with me sometimes. They let me bring him. They paid for him to be there. We stayed in these ridiculously awesome places, like these houses out in the countryside in France. And
wait, they did go out of business, right?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm just hearing all the expenses on the upfront before they sold skis.
Yeah, it was a friend of his. I mean, Guerlain was, he's a cool dude. He had so much passion that people would step in and be like, yeah, they loved his vision. And he did have this awesome vision. I think ultimately one of the issues that I saw with Corrupt was that it was almost like he had too much. He was an athlete at the same time, and he had trouble, you know, he didn't have to step back from that, but it was almost like too much. It would be like trying to make your own feature length film and be the producer, the director, the actor, and then writing it, and then also try to do the promotion for it.
It's too much.
Yeah, it's just too much. But in the beginning, it was pretty cool and had a good time.
And so from there, I know it seems like your next move was over to Kesley, and you ended up with three pro models at Kesley, which is unheard of. No one has three pro models. No one has a ski named after their middle name. I don't think that's ever happened before. And they also released a really creepy video with you to announce that you were on the team. And there was the European Kesley guy saying how you were going to the Olympics, and you were like, I will definitely be in the Olympics. How did that whole thing come together? Did they pay you a shit ton of money? And tell me all about the Kesley experience.
Well, the Kesley experience was awesome because they had the reasons that I was on the team was that when we were in talks, they wanted something more than just a skier. And so I'd been kind of building myself up as as a comedian, I guess, or like I would do other entertaining things, you know, to go along with my segments, which is kind of a different story. But that was like they wanted to have some sort of more personality on it than just like their skier. I think the mistake that we made together was that I was the only one, you know, I kept talking about having other athletes and stuff like that, because I think in my head, I knew that I wasn't going to go to the Olympics. In the beginning, it was pretty obvious. It was an obvious switch to Kesley, just because they gave me full control over what I wanted the skis to be. And the skis were insane. Like they were the best skis I've ever skied on. That's for sure. And I'm not sponsored by them anymore, so I don't have to say that, but I can tell you they're amazing. And like, you know, the hollow tip technology, I thought it was just sort of gimmicky. And they're like, we want to make sure we talk about that. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. We can do promoty shit. And then I first tried them with the hollow tech, and it was like no swing weight. And it was like I had nothing on my feet. They're the lightest skis. It was awesome. And so that's when I was like, yeah, I want to ski on these skis. They're fucking fantastic. Plus then they gave me the other two pro models that I designed. And they're all symmetrical, which is a funny thing to do for a backcountry ski. But
yeah. So did you get a royalty on all three skis?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they sold very many, but the way that it worked was we had like a cap on the sale. So like if I sold a certain amount, or like the skis sold a certain amount, I didn't get a royalty up until a certain amount. And then after that, I got a royalty on those ones.
So you, you know, they bring you on, they want you to be their Olympian, and you could see in that guy's eyes, I mean, he was really excited, but you say, you know, in your head that you probably weren't going to be an Olympian. How did everything end with Kesley? And was there an issue with you not becoming an Olympian?
No, it ended pretty well. They got, you know, I did a couple of videos for them and was still filming and doing that kind of stuff, and did a whole bunch of other things with their Groms team. It seems more dramatic looking at it from the outside, and I think, but it wasn't really. They were another sort of, they were a company a long time ago, you know, a ski company, and they were kind of starting up again. So they were taking chances and doing different things. And so me going to the Olympics, I think they kind of had the mentality, well, like that didn't work. And that was it. It wasn't a huge deal, but, they were still very supportive, and they had me doing a lot of different things, and I really enjoyed that time. It was different being on a team by myself. So I would bring my manager with me because I wanted to, you know, I would go over to Europe and they'd had people that would, you know, bring me around and bring us to different, like bring me to the mountain or bring us to the hotel and stuff like that. So they really took care of me really well. And I would bring my like I said, my manager with me for a little bit of an English conversation since it was in Austria.
It seems like it's not really a team when it's just yourself.
Yeah, it didn't. Chris Davenport was on the team, but he's like a mountaineer. He's like on a completely different side. He's also a machine. That guy runs his program pretty tightly. So it was interesting. I mean, I have a lot of good friends that I got out of that for sure. But yeah, it was definitely a different team feeling.
And that was kind of, I would say, you know, from my perspective, was that kind of the end of your professional ski career?
Yeah, once I was done with that, it had been, years of like all winter. And to be honest, I have a lot of other ambitions for my life and what I want to do, you know. And I learned how to do a switch double Misty. It was like right at that time, Bobby had done it. And I think he was the only other one that had done it. And so I learned the switch double Misty because going back to what we were talking about with competitions, knowing what I was going to do before I got there and being consistent with those tricks all the way, I was picking tricks to learn that nobody else was doing or, you know, not many people were doing. And I was trying to learn doubles and the switch double on the pipe. And I was learning switch double Misty because I knew that if I landed the switch double Misty, a right double and then a, you know, dub 12 or whatever, the switch double Misty could carry me through and I could be doing pretty well. And so I remember I was there with PK, Hunter and Russ at Breckenridge and I finally landed it. I got my balls up and finally landed, did it fine. And I landed it and I skied down and I was like so relieved. I like pulled my goggles off. I was like, oh, phew. And I like put my hands in the air because I was like relieved, not because, and I got down to the bottom of PK. I was like, dude, stop claiming you're like a douche. I'm like, I'm not claiming, dude. I'm like happy to be alive. Right. Like I was, that's when I kind of realized, I was like, all right, well, I wasn't excited to do it again. And I think that's when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to get, I was in my late 20s at that time. So I was, you know, way behind I learned too much, I guess you could say. I didn't have the same balls and the same ability to focus on the positive outcome instead of worry about the consequences of the tricks I was learning.
Well, the funny thing about your skiing and your career is, you know, I met you really early in your career. And I can say from the first day I met you, I realized that you had way more talent outside of skiing than you had on the mountain. And that's not a knock on your skiing at all. I mean, you were third at the X Games on three different occasions. You won the U.S. Open. But in terms of just your vocal abilities, the voiceovers that you can do, your acting, there's no one in skiing that has close to the amount of talent as Colby West. And I often think to myself, you know, whenever you kind of pop into my head, I wonder why you're not famous yet. You need to do a couple of the voices, I think, so the audience can actually hear what you're capable of. I love Tyrone, Optimus Prime. You've got so many great voices. But give us a little bit of what Colby West does best.
Well, I did a voiceover the other day. I did one for... I did it for Seeking Nirvana. I don't know if you watched that ski. There was a bunch of segments with those boys. And
yeah.
They had me do, it was Sam Elliott, you know, the cowboy from The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
I don't know if they ever found it, Nirvana, but it sure was fun watching them try.
And then you have like a voice of God as well. That's pretty amazing, like your movie intro.
In a world plagued with violence, sin, and corruption, one man, one desire.
That is awesome. You're living in Hollywood now, right?
Yeah, I live in Playa del Rey.
Okay, well, I'll just pretend like you live right in Hollywood, right underneath that Hollywood sign, and you're looking for work there, I would think. How do you get your name out there in the world of Hollywood?
Well, it's been interesting because, you know, I as you can see with what we talked about with how I became a pro skier, I kind of went in a different route than, you know, I didn't have a coach. I didn't have, you know, I didn't go to a program. I mean, I went to High North Ski Camp, but who are we kidding? It's not, you go there to ski with pros. You don't really go there to get like professional great coaching.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have that traditional upbringing. I also didn't start in the sport, you know, from my infant age. So with acting and with doing voices and that kind of stuff, I've been sort of, I've done a couple things, but I'm sort of looking for my own way of doing it. You know, I've met with a bunch of agencies and done a bunch of different things in the past couple of years. And it was always like, well, this is standard. This is what you have to do. This is how it goes. And I guess that stubborn side of me is sort of like, well, I'm going to figure out my own way to do it. I want to show how I can be unique and separated from that crowd. It's kind of like jumping out of this, you know, small lake that was skiing into a massive ocean of talent. So it's been interesting, that's for sure. I mean, I've been doing a lot of voiceovers and acting stuff, and I started getting into drift car driving recently.
Yeah, I saw a little video of you where you peed your pants the first time you were in the drift car, and then after a little while, it looked like you figured it out.
Yeah, I went over, Monster brought me over there. I still have a personality deal with Monster, so I do a lot of stuff with them. I made an advertisement for them a couple years ago where I shaved my head bald and did a bunch of characters, and it was like a national ad. And then I did another one for them recently, and then so they bring me around. I'm going next month over to Greece. In October, I'm going over to Greece to a Gymkhana Grid. I just really love, it's like the freestyle of car driving. And so that's really what I really want to get into now. And I bought a car, 1971 Ford Maverick, and it's up in Washington, actually up in Seattle. Are you still in Seattle?
I am in Seattle.
All right. Well, I guess I'll see you soon then, because my builder's up in Seattle and we're going to start building the car up there. And hopefully that works out. It's going to be super fun. But yeah, I guess, I mean, going back to like getting jobs down here and stuff like that, it's fun. I like doing voiceovers and I like acting stuff, but it's just like some of it's really fucking boring, man. It's like going from being a pro skier and traveling everywhere and the actual job is a physical thing. You know, I'm an athlete, I guess, more than anything. So it's been really difficult to like force myself to have to sit down and like memorize lines or do things, you know, it just doesn't feel like me. So I'm still finding my area with that, because that's what, I mean, as you said before, you know, people compliment me on my voices and my ability to do that. And
you're the best, man. It's not just complimenting you. It's like, you are so good. I think there's a lot of people in the ski industry. All the people I talk to, everyone had the same question. It's like, why isn't that kid famous yet? Everyone believes in you because just the voices that you have. I mean, we heard three here and I laughed pretty hard, but you have like 20 voices and you're super talented at that. I think a lot of people are wondering when you're going to blow up and you're going to be everywhere, because I think that's what everybody expects from you. And when you say that you're an athlete, you are an athlete, but to me, you're a talent first with a ton of athletic ability that was able to make a career out of skiing, but eventually will have his career in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's just trying to find my in or my niche or how I can make it. I was actually listening to an interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger the other day, and just listening to his transformation from being an athlete to becoming an actor, and how he knew that he had to find the right roles and the right things to do that were good for him. I mean, I've been doing a lot of things on my own. I kind of more or less took a break from trying to shove myself into things as well. I wanted to like relax and figure out how to do it the right way. And I did the Colby West show, which was live audience TV show in Whistler about 2 years ago. And that to me, actually Sean Pettit was on the show and Gus Kenworthy. And that is something that I'd love to do. Like if I could have one person's job in Hollywood, it'd be like Jimmy Fallon and something like that. Because I love the interaction with other people. You can do skits, you can do all that stuff. And it would just be, I would just love to be able to do something like that. I've been working on how I can do that. That's what I want.
And I've also seen your vlog out there. I don't even know how you say it because I don't do that. But is that dead? It seemed like it was going on a daily basis and I haven't seen any updates lately.
Oh, the vlog. Yeah, that was a cool experiment. GoPro hooks me up with cameras. And so I was like sitting there trying to figure out what we're going to do. And I'm working on all these different projects, and the Hollywood shit takes fucking forever to get done. So I was like, well, fuck this. I have cameras. I know how to edit a little bit. I can just do this myself. And so I challenged myself to do a month of vlogging, which I thought was funny. Calling it a vlog is fucking hilarious to me. I mean, Yoon Olsen does a daily video blog. It does pretty well. But I was watching some of them, and not his necessarily, but like a lot of video blogs are pretty boring because it is like daily life. And so my challenge was to see how, like, what I could come up with on the day. It was really fun because you wake up and you're like, okay, what am I going to do today? And then you film that day, and then you edit at night, and you wake up and you do it again. And it was a really good exercise in being creative daily. That was kind of my whole purpose in doing that. I had a really good time. I didn't get much traction with it. I think some people liked it, but that really wasn't the purpose. I wasn't trying to like get a gajillion sponsors and be like, what's up guys, don't forget to subscribe to my channel. It was just like a fun exercise in creativity.
But you use Mark Getz to say, what's up, guys, subscribe. Or he used it to subscribe to his channels.
Yeah, it's super funny. Margetz has been great. Oh, another thing that reminds me, Margetz and I went, Margetz and Tom Dalzell and a couple of my other buddies, we did a music tour. I started playing music a couple years ago, playing guitar and singing. And we did a little mini music tour. It was actually last year at this time, and went from in LA and played a show in Mammoth and then played a show in Tahoe and then went down to the Sheckler Golf Tournament. But that's another thing that was sort of like a, let's see how this goes. I don't have patience for, you know, building it up from the beginning and getting all the cash together and like the marketing and that type of stuff. So I've just been trying out pretty much everything.
Gotcha. And just seeing if something sticks right away.
Yeah. Seeing if something sticks or what I like, you know, so I realized I really like playing on stage. I like doing that, but I don't have an audience here in LA. So right now I'm planning on doing a tour in the wintertime to all of the ski areas. Cause I have my friend is a pro acoustic version that people seem to like. I played a show up in Whistler this summer and it's so inspiring because, like, you know, I play like a bunch of songs people know, cover some songs, and it's mostly like cowboy shit, like House of the Rising Sun and White Buffalo and stuff like that. But that really appeals to me a lot because that's you just entertaining, like it's like core entertaining to me.
Well, Colby, I want to thank you for coming on. I know that we're all going to hear some amazing things from you in the next few years, because one of these things you're going to stick to while you have a bunch of projects and you don't like doing the marketing up front. I think at some point you are going to do the marketing up front. You're going to pick that one path you want to take and you're going to blow up and it's going to be a global thing, because the talent that you have is undeniable. You had an amazing talent on the ski hill, but really I think your talent is off the hill, and I'm excited to see what you put together moving forward.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, man.
Hey, no problem, man, and I thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, all right. Have a good time.
I hope you enjoyed that time with Colby West. If you want some more Colby West, you can head over to thepowellmovement.com. We've got a bonus segment, Inappropriate Questions. Colby's going to answer three questions from Wayne Wong. Then he's going to put together three questions for next week's guest, Chris Benchetler. Colby is a true talent, and it's going to be interesting to see where he lands in the coming years. His talent is undeniable. I think you heard a little snippet of it on the show, and he's got a lot more when that came from. You can check out his website at colbyjameswest.com, and it's been amazing to see his rags-to-riches story. He started out his ski career driving from the East Coast to the West, living in the back of a 1989 Saab, and chasing the dream, and he was able to make that dream a reality. He stood on X Games podiums, won a few contests, and I can't wait to see what's next from Colby West. If you have any questions for Chris Benchetler next week or want to provide some show feedback, you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter or shoot me an email at mike@thepowellmovement.com. I want to thank you again for listening to Sponsored. Hopefully you'll check out Inappropriate Questions on thepowellmovement.com. On behalf of Powder Radio, I'm Mike Powell, and thanks for listening to Sponsored.